Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a couple of questions. How aligned are the United States and France on the war in Ukraine? And how aligned are they on everything else? Let's get to the bottom line. France has always argued that Europe should be able to have its own unique foreign policies, even if they don't line up 100% with those of Europe's biggest ally, the United States. At the start of the Ukraine war about a year ago, French President Emmanuel Macron said the West must be careful not to humiliate Russia and emphasized France's ability to act as a mediator when the time comes for negotiations. As Macron has also pushed the concept of European strategic autonomy and a new concept called the European Political Community that brings together 27 EU leaders with 17 other leaders from the continent currently outside the club, including the UK, Turkey, Norway, and Ukraine. Despite this, Biden gave his first state dinner last year celebrating the French president and elevated the alliance to one of the most vital and compelling America has. So how closely are America and France aligned? Where do the two countries agree, and where do they agree to disagree? Today, we're talking with veteran French diplomat Philippe Etienne, the ambassador of France to the United States, and before that, chief diplomatic advisor to the president of France. Ambassador Etienne, thank you so much for joining us here today. You're right on the edge of leaving your post and going off to be a professor at Columbia to think great thoughts and perhaps write great books. But I'm interested in getting your strategic map as you look not just at the French-American relationship, but the world, about what you think we're not getting right. What do we as allies need to focus on? What worries do you have out there that are unaddressed right now?
Indeed, I think the war in Ukraine, this aggression by Russia against Ukraine, is something, it's very bad news. It's also very, very big news. It's a war back to Europe so many years after World War II. And my experience is that in February when it started, and even before it started, because we knew it could come, we have had since then all the time a very close coordination between the United States and its European allies, including the European Union as such, which is so important, as you said, for us, but also for the other member states of the EU. And this is a reassuring in a very dire situation, and it says a lot about the depths of our alliance when we have to face such a critical situation. At that time, in February last year, France was the chair of the Council of the European Union. So we had a big responsibility, both in terms of uniting the member states of the 27 member states of the EU, but also in this relation with the United States. Again, we have nothing to be happy about what happened, what's happening now, considering the sufferings of the Ukrainian people and what means this war against all principles of international security committed, and this being committed by one of the five permanent members of the Security Council of the UN. It means so much for our international order, but still we have this reassuring factor that our alliance is strong and has proved strong. Of course, this has been confirmed during the state visit made by our president to Washington and New Orleans to the United States.
And it was President Biden's first state dinner.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was about to say the first state visit under the mandate of this administration. We are very honored, but as you said, it meant probably something about the depth, of this oldest alliance, but also about what it is today, about how strong it remains and how important it will remain in the future for addressing the other challenges we will maybe speak about now.
Are you worried, though, and I don't know if I'm going to get this out right, but are you worried that there were many people that doubted the solvency of NATO before this Russian incursion into Ukraine? Even President Macron before came out and talked about NATO being brain dead, that people were not looking at how to make the relationship, that it required this shock of the Russian invasion so that the transatlantic relationship could be reunified. You know, are you worried that we're too dependent on other things to happen so that the alliance can react strongly? But when that bad event doesn't happen, we were drifting apart.
Well, first, such an alliance, which is an alliance on security, has been built to ensure the security of its members in the transatlantic community and to face such events, to be able to answer. And you mentioned the statement made by President Macron, a couple of years ago, but the context was very different. Mm. It was another U.S. administration, as you remember. And you remember what then the president of the then president of the U.S.
during
said.
President Trump's term, yeah.
And you remember some of the statements about NATO. So, but also, we had another issue, which to a certain extent remains, and we have this terrible earthquake right now, which hits the populations in Turkey and Syria. We must also remember that at that time, we had really difficult discussions about the attitude we should have in Syria with one of our allies, Turkey in that case. And this was, and this is still sensitive for us, because the terrorist attacks against Paris in 2015 were plotted from northeast Syria, as you may remember, you know, November 2015. So this was a context. Since then, even under the Trump administration, and still more after the new administration, there was a big work which has been done at NATO, including on the conception of what we are for, including reaffirming that we are here to ensure our common security against in Europe in particular, or in the Atlantic region. And this has been, of course, very useful when Russia has invaded Ukraine. And one of the things we had done, which was really important, as NATO, was to reinforce our eastern flank. France has sent troops and equipment to Romania, for instance,
right?
Because those countries are on the front line, if I may say so. And the second thing which has been important, the EU as such is now a provider of security, also because security, the notion of security, is much larger. It is not only defense, it's cyber, it is energy, it is critical technologies, and the EU has now become a real actor. Look at our
reactions. Well, this raises a really interesting question as you define security and threats. And one of my pet peeves is we now define February 24th as the start of the Ukraine war. President Biden has announced he's going to go to Poland on that day and be in Poland on the day the war began. But actually, in my book, the war began on February 23rd, because that's when the cyber attack from Russia actually began against Ukraine. Lots of defensive measures, and that story turned out to be a rather good one for Ukraine. But when we think about tanks and we think about cyber sabotage, we don't treat them the same way. So I guess my question to you is twofold. Is, one, do we need to think differently about what we think drives conflict? Do we need to move in and look at these tech interests? And the other thing is, the president's going to Poland. Is the center of gravity in Europe shifting from the Western European countries to some of the Eastern European edge of Europe?
First, the Ukrainians say rightly that the war did not start on February 24 or on February 23, but
Crimea,
a couple of years before, right. Exactly. And we know this also because France and Germany at that time were involved and tried to stop this first war, but also to mediate. And we know then what happened and how the Russian leadership has decided to go to another, still more brutal war of invasion. But indeed, yes, cyber and other dimensions. Energy is weaponized in a way and could be used as an element of pressure. We see a lot of different elements coming in to define the new security. What is security today? And we have to, of course, to have as integrate, as consistent vision of all those challenges to our security. this thing, the idea of security has evolved because we have new spaces of conflictuality. Cyberspace is one of those domains. We have also the space over our heads, which is becoming more
genuine
and more,
outer space,
and which is becoming more and more an incredible perspective for our future, with the relaunch of the space adventure on the moon and then on Mars, but also more and more also an issue for our common security. And look at the seas, the oceans also. It's more and more, as we see in the Indo-Pacific, in the Atlantic, it becomes again a real issue of sovereignty, of security. So we have to take all of this into account. And we have in NATO, we have adapted, as in the EU, as in the United States, we have new concepts. We have new strategy of securities.
And how about the role of Eastern Europe right now? Is it rising?
When we, the older members of the founding members of the European Union, we have seen those countries liberated from the dictatorship, from the communism. We have, of course, reached out to them because they have always been important countries for Europe. Poland, Romania, where I was ambassador in Bucharest, you know, those countries, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, the Baltic Republics, all of them, also Bulgaria, Romania, all those countries matter for Europe. You know, I'm passionate about the European integration, as you might know, Steve, because we met a lot of times during my time in Washington. Every country matters in the EU. For me, it is not really interesting to say, is this country more important now or has it been? They have always been important. The reunification of Europe with Poland, with Romania, with the others, was such an essential development of the European Union. So, of course, they are important, maybe still more important now with the new geopolitical context, but they are important anyway.
Well, you were at the President Biden's State of the Union address recently, and it struck me that President Biden did spend a lot of time talking about how vital the global struggle for democracy is. And I look at some parts of Eastern Europe, and you know the countries, you know, Hungary, you've seen some other countries, that you have to be honest, democracy and democratic practice and norms were, to be kind, wobbly. And maybe, again, the Russian invasion of Ukraine has actually helped the Democrats out somewhat in some of these countries. But when it comes to values and democratic practice, do you have problems inside Europe that maybe Russia is trying to exacerbate? Are there blind spots there that we should shine a light on?
I think democracy is by far the best system for our freedoms. But we know it is not an easy system. It is fragile, and you know it also in the United States. So at the age of social media, for instance, we have to defend our democracies. We have to defend the values which are defining our democracies, such as the freedom of speech, but also the defense of the security of our people. All of this is really a fine balance to find, but also an adaptation to convince our people that the democracy is well alive. We are doing this in the EU because the EU, with all its member states, is based on the idea of democracy. The European Union, the European integration from the very beginning, at the beginning of the 1950s, has been a political union, not only an economic union. And at the base of this political union, there are the notions of democracy and freedoms. So, of course, we have to have the conversation inside our community. But to come back to the war in Ukraine, this is a war for the freedom of our peoples. And we must be aware not to limit this to the West or to the United States or to European nations and the United States. It's about the freedom of a people, the possibility for every nation to resist to an invasion, to keep its freedom. What the Ukrainians are fighting for is so important for us. And it is not only a question of Western democracies. It is a matter for everybody around the world, every nation which wants to keep its freedom, its national freedom, but also the personal freedom of its citizens.
How worried are you about the fragility in the transatlantic economic relationship? Recently, we've had the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, in Washington, D.C., and the German economics minister and vice chancellor, Richard Habeck, here basically lobbying the government to keep open the Inflation Reduction Act. Don't want to get into that, folks, but it's basically America's Green New Deal, you know, softly deployed to look at all energy development and making sure that Europeans, but there's an element of nationalism in it, domestic procurement requirements, and some in Europe are saying, hey, we need to do the same thing over there. We need to subsidize our own green new industries in Europe. And I was listening to Bruno Le Maire and others talk about a race to subsidies and something that could be negative for both sides. Do you worry about that? Is there a fragility there that we should be thinking about?
We have this conversation. It was together with the war in Ukraine. It was one of the main topics of the political discussion during the state visit of President Macron with President Biden and also with the members of the Congress he met. We fundamentally agree with the political goals of the Inflation Reduction Act, we in Europe, which is to fight for our climate, for the climate, which is one of the most important challenges we all face, but also to build both in Europe and in the United States strong green industries, strong green technologies, which make us and our supply chains more resilient. Mm. The issue is to coordinate. As our minister said, you recall he warned against a race to subsidies. The coordination is important to avoid this. And also because since we share the same political goals, we should be sure that each of our policy, our political instruments, our supports, our subsidies are reinforcing our common goals, our two goals, resilient supply chains and technologies, and efficient fight against the climate. Mm. So it is true that the Europeans are worried, have expressed some worries about some parts of the, some provisions of the IA, but we have this conversation and we have reached already some results. And we will do the same in the EU, indeed. We have started, of course, we have started before the US. We are in the EU, we have a sort of leadership in the world for the negotiation on climate. But, and we have, because we have very ambitious goals, minus 55% of carbon emissions by 2030. It's a very ambitious goal. So we have started this climate policy in the EU, but now we will step them up, a bit like the US, and we have to coordinate and to avoid between our economies negative effects, but in the contrary, to ensure that each of our policy is reinforcing our common goals. The achievement of our common goals.
Look, let me ask you a question here that I hope we can get a candid answer on. And I know that many U.S. government officials...
I give always candid answers.
U.S. government officials right now, Karen Donfried, but many others celebrate you as a diplomat extraordinaire. But I'm interested in how often you find America completely a schizophrenic partner. Like sometimes we're on and on the right message, sometimes we're off. And I ask this with regards to strategic autonomy, which fascinates me, because this is one of Macron's important initiatives. And from my perspective as an American, I think that France and Europe overall, being more capable about its own interests, more thoughtful about its own interests, more committed to stability there, is a great global good and something the United States should want. But sometimes I think the United States says, we want strategic autonomy too, but we want you to do what we want you to do. And so how much tension is there in the strategic economy game?
Well, first, what you describe is pretty natural, isn't it? I mean...
Very natural.
It's for the Europeans to do their things.
Yeah.
And also, I was always surprised when we speak about sovereignty or autonomy. It's normal that the Europeans are willing to decide for their own interests and for their own future. The question of sovereignty is an important one in the world, and it is not at all related against the U.S. On the contrary, we have in the world other actors, big challenges, which make that it is both more sometimes delicate and also more important to defend our own sovereignty. And I've always been convinced and even passionate with this, that it's really important for the United States in the long term, but also in the short term, by the way, to have a stronger European Union, which, you know, for instance, where the US can rely on its European allies to do certain things on their own. It's obviously in the interest of the US, both in the security field, but also for the economy, and to have, as we said before, to have a strong industrial technological base on the two sides of the Atlantic, including for our own defense, is important. You look at what happens in Ukraine. We have to provide the Ukrainians with some equipment. We have to have the industrial base for doing that.
Let me ask you, you know, we all have a big conflict with Russia right now with what's going on in Ukraine, but when Emmanuel Macron calls Putin, Putin picks up the phone. We have a lot of tensions with China right now. When Macron calls Xi Jinping picks up the phone. Is France America's negotiator? Is it the diplomatic offshore balancer?
I am sure that America is able to negotiate, and also the U.S. government speaks with China, for instance, if we had recently some issues there. We do not pretend to be the only ones who speak with everybody, but you know, one of the basic recipes of the diplomatic work is you have to talk to the people with whom you disagree, because if you only talk to the people with whom you agree, it is not really useful. So yes, we think also, as one of the five permanent members of the Security Council of the United Nations, that we have this responsibility, and this responsibility is global, and including in the context of the war in Ukraine, it's really important that we keep a contact, we deepen the contact with also the developing countries, the emerging countries. You spoke about Russia, China, you're right, but look at all the other important members of the international community, all the other G20 members. It's so important, both to discuss the war in Ukraine, which is a threat to everybody in the world, as I said, but also the global challenges. Poverty remains a challenge, but also health, global health, we have seen with COVID, climate, biodiversity. It is important to speak to everybody. And we, it's a bit a DNA of our diplomacy. And our president is very active indeed on this international scene.
Well, Ambassador Philippe Etienne, thanks for joining us today, and good luck on your next venture.
Thank you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? Friendship and trust between leaders and countries can go very far, but the only real thing that is dependable between nations is permanent interests. France has been America's ally from day one, in part because France did believe in the idea of égalité and liberté, but perhaps more because it was an expedient course to take as France was gripped in a global struggle 250 years ago with England. There may have been hiccups along the way, but Paris and Washington are on the same side in so many global conflicts. Macron's efforts to push back here and there and work on European strategic autonomy is not really seen as a threat by the United States, which doesn't have the resources or the same worldview as Europe on some strategic issues. America is not always paying attention. Sometimes it wants Europe to have strategic autonomy, and let's face it, sometimes it just wants to take orders and do what America wants it to do. Washington can be a bit schizophrenic and bipolar, but that's the nature of a lot of relationships, sort of like a long-term marriage that still works. And that's the bottom line.